The Russia-Ukraine war. So many times I've been telling you, actually, ever since this channel even existed, that there is no path to a military victory for Ukraine. I have also told you that there is no longer even a path to avoid defeat from the Russian side. They just can't. They're, when you look at the balance of power between the two sides, it's irrevocably on the Russian side. And as I've been saying in recent weeks, the dynamic is continuing to expand in the opposite directions. The Ukraine side has suffered over 147,000 desertions in this year as of the end of September. That number continues to go up. They, of course, continue to have huge number of casualties. We don't know what the actual number is, but it's substantial. They can't recruit enough people, and there aren't enough weapons to go from the Western side altogether, if everything from the United States, from Europe, et cetera. On the other side of the balance, of course, we have the Russian side, which has no manpower shortage. They continue month after month to expand the total number on active duty, despite however many troops that they suffer in casualties or even any desertions that they may have. It's still not a trickle compared to the flood of troops that they have coming in. And then on the economic front and the military industrial capacity front, Russia builds up so many more weapons. Their capacity continues to expand, especially in the nature of the strategic drones, the Garand-2s, their missile components, their glide bombs. Their air force continues to completely dominate the Ukraine side. Everything you want to measure says that. Now, one would imagine, one would hope, maybe a better way to put it, that the Western side would recognize that. Maybe even privately they would understand that, whatever public things they may say. We've seen evidence that maybe that's not the case. Well, today we have a new piece of evidence. Just today in the Atlantic Council, there's this article you can see on the screen right there, Dispatch from Ukraine, the path to a durable peace is emerging. Now, this seems to go against the grain. Just on the headline, you think, wait a minute, durable peace, something that the Ukraine side would want? This author here is written by Frederick Kemp, who is the president and CEO of the Atlantic Council. And he apparently just got back from a secret trip where he went to the front lines. And so you might think also, well, goodness, if you went to the front lines, if you actually went to Ukraine, you would certainly be able to see up close and personal all these dynamics that I just mentioned, in fact, even more graphically so, and come back with a rather sobering view that this really has no chance. But that's not what this article says. And I'm going to point out to you that this is the latest example of what the so-called elite thinking in America is producing, and why I say it is fatally corrupted and something you shouldn't even listen to anymore. This is just, it's hard for me to imagine that this is written on the 10th of October of 2025, well over 3.5 years into this war, now rolling in toward the end of 4 years. It's just unfathomable that somebody could say these things in public, because the intent of this is to draw policies from the United States government and friendly Western governments. That's what it's designed to do. And there's good reason why you may think this. Let me show you a little bit about why this is why this article may be written here, and what you need to understand about who wrote it. When you're looking at something, you need to understand where they're coming from. Well, let's take a look here, because here is Frederick Kemp. Here he is, the author, president, CEO of the organization, and the author of this. So, what are his credentials in terms of military affairs, that he would understand the dynamics of play? Well, you look and you see that he is the president, chief executive. Under his leadership, the council has achieved historic industry-leading growth in size and influence. Okay, so he's really good at growth and influence for his organization and his magazine. Then you see, before the council, he was a prize-winning editor and reporter at the Wall Street Journal. 25 years in New York, he served as assistant managing editor, blah, blah, blah. Goes on down there. So he was a good writer. He's a really good fundraiser, and he's done really good for his organization there. That's one of the things that he's done. Terrific. That's good. For the Atlantic Council, that's good qualifications. For his organization to get funding and to get influence, he's doing a bang-up job. So understandable why he's in there. But let's look at where some of that money comes from. Always, they say, follow the money, and that'll tell you all you need to know. And this is a shining example, or a dark example of exactly that issue here. According to their published information, in the year 2024, They reported they had at least contributions of $1 million from the government of the UK, the U.S. Department of Defense, and the U.S. Department of State. From the years 2019 to 2023, they were the number one think tank in the United States that got foreign money in excess of $20 million. So the Atlantic Council is an international elite organization that gets all their money from these countries. And you've seen what the UK has said. You know what they're doing. And you certainly see what the Department of State, the Department of Defense, they're all about expanding war. They seem to be, it's almost like conglomerated both what was the Department of Defense and Department of State into the Department of War. You might as well just lump them all together in there. In fact, the Secretary of State is the National Security Advisor right now. He never gave up that hat. They never tried to put it on somebody else. So it conglomerates it all into one. So it's no surprise then that this organization would come up with something that says, hey, let's keep going down the path of war. So let's take a look at what he actually said here. Now, he says that this was a secret trip to the front lines where he went up and made a lot of direct observations. Let me bring that the article itself up. This is the Dispatch. So this is on the Atlantic Council. You can find it on their homepage. And one of the things he says right up front, which is again, an early line that something is not right. And it says, welcome to the front lines of freedom. So that tells you a lot right there from the beginning, is that he is having this globalist view that Zelensky repeats ad nauseum, and so does Emmanuel Macron, definitely Keir Starmer, that and Ursula von der Leyen. Those are the ones that are the big chorus leaders at various times, the soloists in the choir talking about how this they're fighting for us. They're defending the West. So that tells you a lot you need to know as well. But then it continues on. It says, well into the fourth year of Russia's criminal, unprovoked, and now stalemated war, the deadliest and most consequential since World War II. So that's repeating that canard that this, number one, was unprovoked. We have shown you thoroughly and had many guests on here with authoritatively showed you that was far from unprovoked. In fact, there were a number of substantial provocations all the way in the years leading up to this. You can in some respects go back to 2007 and 2008, but definitely to 2014 through the Minsk Accords, everything that happened in 2021, and then of course into the actual start of the war, which Russia did choose. No question about that, but it was hardly unprovoked. And some of the things that were existing for the Russian side, we would never, ever on our side allow anything less than he did. Those are facts, my friends. But you see that there he's repeating this unprovoked canard because he wants to build up pressure. He wants to build up support for, yes, Russia is evil, Ukraine is good. Ukraine is the victim. Russia is the unprovoked aggressor. But then he also says it's a now stalemated war. Now, this is not a stalemated war. This is a war that very much is going in the Russian favor. It is going at a much slower pace than anybody in the West would ever do if we were the ones in the advantage. But that's the path that the Russians are on. Even with that slowness, though, the casualties are mounting up for the Ukraine in astronomical numbers, numbers that cannot be sustained. You hear me say on this channel many times, and it is definitely appropriate to repeat here, war is all about men, not machines, not money. Ultimately, you've got to have all three of those. But without the manpower, it doesn't even matter how much money or machines you have if you don't have the people to use them, if you don't have the trained people to use them. Ukraine doesn't. And it continues to shrink by the month because their casualties and desertions exceed the number of people that they're bringing in. It's just a mathematical of calculations. It's evident on the battlefield. The front lines continue to shrink. The air war by the Russian side continues to expand. There's no truth in what they say here, and yet that's what they continue on. Then we go down a little bit further here that he claims that there are three scenarios where Ukraine can win. There are three scenarios for Ukraine's future. And let's get into some of those and what they are. First one here, let's see, the first one he's talking about, such a victory. Yeah, Ukrainians know that a complete victory is impossible for the moment. So he says for the moment, but we're going to get back into that some more here. Such a victory would involve Ukraine regaining roughly 20% of its territory that the Kremlin had seized, receiving billions of dollars in war reparations from Russia, and witnessing the international prosecution of Vladimir Putin. Those are all fantasies. All those are fantasies. Those are never going to happen under any circumstances. And yet there he repeats, that's what a victory would look like. That's in someone's dreams at night that are no relation to reality. But that's where he's starting from. That, again, tells you what's to follow is probably going to fall in the same line as this. At the same time, this is important, Ukrainians are just as convinced that Russia will never achieve Putin's maximalist goals of taking all of Ukraine and Stalin collaborators as leaders of this country. Now, that's kind of rich in that that's where a lot of the seeds of this one began, because the West did precisely that. They installed a puppet government of the West's preference and unseated the legally elected leader of Ukraine, which happened to be someone who was leaning towards Russia. So what they're accusing Russia of wanting to do, our side has done, oblivious to that fact, doesn't say anything about it. So he says, all right, well, if that maximalist stuff is not possible here, since we, quote, know Ukraine or Russia isn't going to win, then that leaves three realistic possibilities. And then he talks into them. The first one is a war of attrition. He says the least desirable is an extended war of attrition, which would favor Russia given its larger population, military, and in manufacturing base. Okay, this is the one point to where he actually says something that's accurate and honest. But then it gets weird, because after recognizing that Russia has an advantage in population, its military is bigger, stronger, and more capable, and its manufacturing base dwarfs everything the entire cumulative West, to include Ukraine, Europe, and the United States, can put together. That should stop your assessment right there and say, okay, well, there is no military path to success here at all. But unfortunately, he doesn't. He continues on. So that's apparently option one. Option two is what they call a fake peace. Which is nearly as bad as what they call a fake peace, in which Russia stops the fighting for a time, but under conditions that fail to secure Ukraine or prevent a future attack. So they're saying that basically what this option is, which I think is also nearly as much of a fantasy as the stuff above, to where the Russia will just stop fighting. They'll just say, okay, you know, the current line of contact, that's it. Whatever we have, we'll just hold on to that. But there's not going to be any kind of security guarantees for anybody. They'll just stop until they can build up the capability to launch a future attack. So that's not even real. So he's talking about three options here. So far, there are no real ones here. Then he comes to what he considers the best outcome possible scenario, is a fair and durable peace with some Ukrainian territory lost for now, but European military boots on the ground, an American security backstop, and an accelerated path to EU membership. Okay, so it looks like the whole thing's just going to stay in the fantasy territory. There is nothing realistic other than that one sentence above where he acknowledged Russia's larger population, military, manufacturing base. He then ignores the reality of that and then goes back into outright fantasy. And then here, that you want a durable peace, a fair and durable peace. According to whose definition? Obviously, Zelensky's, obviously the Western Europeans, the elite of the West right now. You want to define what a fair and durable peace is. And look, if you don't include the Russian side in this and their needs, then you don't get durable. However you want to perversely define fair, if the Russians aren't even involved in the process and all they're going to do is get to receive diktats from the West, then it won't be durable. Any more than the West expanding the NATO military bloc from 2007 against the warnings of Russia all the way up to its border, and then preparing to go into Ukraine and into the 2020-2021 period, then you already got war for that very reason. So there's no way that, short of eliminating those possibilities, you wouldn't get it in the future. So there is going to be no fair and durable peace if Russia's not involved. And then let's look at the other issues there. European military boots on the ground. European military boots on the ground. That's part of his durable peace. And under what conditions can you even imagine that Russia would go, okay, we'll agree to something that's going to allow European troops, i.e. some NATO countries, to put their boots on the ground in Ukraine? The very reason they went to war in the first place. They're obviously not going to do that. And then even less likely is an American security backstop. America is not going to provide a security backstop. Secretary Hegseth has made that clear from the time he took office. President Trump has bent over backwards to say that there's never going to be any NATO. He recognized that NATO into Ukraine is what spawned the war in the first place. He said that publicly. There is no way that President Trump is going to use American security backstop. And what that means, make sure you're clear on this, means that if whatever terms that he hypothetically would be agreed to in the future, that if they're broken, then the U.S. would intervene on behalf of Ukraine militarily, like an Article 5 kind of situation. That's what an American security backstop equals. And if it doesn't equal, it's not a security backstop. It's a piece of paper that means nothing. And yet that's what we're left to be. So then he continues on. There's a sense in Ukraine that this third scenario is more likely today than it was at the beginning of the year when Trump first appeared ambivalent about Ukraine's fate. So he says, yeah, Ukraine is now hopeful that things have changed now, and we're going to get on to that. But let's look at that. I'm sorry. The other thing I mentioned there was the EU accelerated path to EU membership. I mean, let's just add one more fantasy in there. I mean, why not? Right. If you're throwing a bunch of stuff that can't be realistic, let's do that, too. This one is definitely not going to happen. I mean, it's been bogged down to this accelerated path. And you've seen Hungarian leaders, from Orbán to his foreign minister, just categorically say we're not going to support that, period. They'll do it like everybody else did, or they're not going to get in. We will not authorize it. We will not agree to it, period, full stop. And there's no reason why they should back down, because they say that would be a drain on the entire European Union. So that's not going to happen. And even the other countries, there's a reason why it hasn't succeeded up to this point, because other countries don't want to anchor put on their economies. So that one's not going to happen either. And if you're predicating all these things have to happen in order to get peace, then you're basically painting a picture that should tell any rational thinking person there's not going to be a peace that's to your Kiev's preference. It's just not going to happen. But let's go on down, because they base all these this hope for these three things on three primary reasons. Number one is that they believe that Trump will help to make it so. So they say this new Ukraine diplomatic dynamic. In his meeting with the Ukrainian leader, Trump confirmed U.S. readiness to support, alongside Europe, a fund that could produce as much as $90 billion of long-range term loans for Ukraine. $90 billion. Now, that has been said openly by Zelensky. He made a, we put it up there a comment maybe 10 days or so ago, where he says, yes, we're ready to sign a $90 billion package. Now, remember, the final one that Joe Biden administration signed was $61 billion. Now, all of a sudden, here's this claim of $90 billion. Well, where is that going to come from? So other than Zelensky saying it in a few oblique references, and this one here, who is going to provide $90 billion worth of loans for Ukraine? Now, they claim, as you see in the next sentence there, that $300 billion would come from stolen Russian assets. That's still a big thorny issue that many in the West even are still very reticent to do because of the precedence that would set and the potential negative fallout for their own interests possibly in the future. So they've been unwilling to do that. It's completely illegal. It's nothing but stolen, because we're not at war with Russia, and yet you're trying to steal their assets that are frozen in Western banks, which makes us look even less reliable and makes other countries less willing to put their money into the West for fear that it could be taken out at a time of their choosing. So that's one of the reasons, just out of self-interest, a lot have been against it, but that's what they still want to say. But then you have other issues too. Whatever the number of dollars comes, wherever they come from, wherever that other $61 billion, it's supposed to buy weapons for Ukraine. Where is $90 billion worth of weapons going to come from? I mean, we've already basically, through the West, emptied out all of our excess stuff from 2022 all the way through 2024. And then now even into this year, too. If still small numbers of things continue to trickle out, Ukraine is trying to build up its domestic industry, but it's very, very small. Because Russia keeps hitting all their abilities in their factories with long-range drones and strikes, which continued on even through last night. So that is going to keep that at a very, very low pace, not enough at all to offset the losses, et cetera. But the West doesn't have it either. The United States doesn't have it. We have allegedly promised the United States to sell $1 billion worth of weapons and ammunition to Ukraine each month over the next 10. So that's 10, not 90. And I don't even know for sure. The only place that can come from is from existing stocks, because our domestic ability to produce these weapons and ammunition at scale doesn't exist. So you can get some of it out, but the only option is to drain our stockpiles even more. Now, this has ramifications for the potential future, and I hope this is not lost on a lot of our NATO countries or the White House, is that in the event that thing ever go bad and sideways with Russia and we get into a conventional war, which unfortunately is still on the table, we are basically denuding our own selves today by drawing down our stockpiles. So we don't have a defense industrial base that can sustain a war of attrition like Russia is doing right now. We don't have it. It doesn't even exist. But now then, you're taking even what stocks you have of both ammunition and key weapon systems and drawing them down further. So in the event that the unthinkable happened and you end up in a conventional war with Russia, we're at a massive disadvantage, because it doesn't matter what you do and look on paper. How many tanks do we have versus Russia? How many people do we have versus Russia? How big is our economy versus Russia, et cetera? Those things are only relevant insofar as the terms that the industrial base and your ability to sustain war are commensurate with those numbers, and they aren't. Russia has an outsizing comparison ability to sustain conflict. They can sustain this for a long time, and they are not using, by all accounts, anywhere near as much ammunition per month that they're producing. Apparently, it's a lot more. Most is going into storage, so their stockpiles are going up while ours are going down. So in the event we get into a war, regardless of how many tanks, planes, and rocket systems we have, we don't have the ammunition to sustain conflict, and then we would be literally defenseless. That's the truth. Don't miss that point, my friends. We need to pay attention to that. Okay, moving on. The second reason is that they say, he says it's now time to move on to the issue with technology. So he says it's not even just personnel that matters. He says it's actually more technology. And let's see if I can find this one. I don't want to miss it here. So he said, one of the strongest impressions I got, this is again the CEO of the Atlantic Council, is that I got on the ground in Ukraine, is that the war is now characterized more by technology race than a battle for territory. Though one informs the other, he continues to say. Then he goes on talking about advanced drone technologies, etc. And this is another issue where he's looking at this just from the Ukrainian position. And there is no question that Ukraine has been masterful at developing drone technology, developing counter-drone technology, drones that take out other drones, electronic warfare capabilities, offensive capabilities. You have these big, I think some are calling them Baba Yaga drones, or just these massive things that can drop multiple bombs. They can drop huge tank mines. Huge explosive capacity, whatever. I can deliver things to the front line. They have reconnaissance drones. They have regular bomber drones. They, of course, have first-person view kamikaze drones, etc. All those, lots of different categories. And they are substantial, and they have caused Russia difficulties, a lot of difficulties on the front line. That's only half of the equation, because the Russian side is doing the same thing, both in electronic warfare, in all the different classes of bombs and bombing and reconnaissance drones and all that, except they're doing more of them because they have a bigger industrial base, a bigger capacity. So far, everything that the Ukraine side has been doing has been mirrored by the Russian side. And it just kind of goes back and forth a little bit about who's in the advantage at any one given time. So if you're going to talk about the Ukraine side and you're talking about how they have a chance to actually achieve a diplomatic outcome that's to their favor, you have to look at the other side of the equation. It's impossible not to if you're realistic, if you're intelligent, and if you're actually looking for a realistic possibility of how you're going to get to this end. That's what you would have to do. That's not what they're doing. They're only looking at the half of it. Last reason. This is the oddest one of all. Basically, they want to butter up Trump. Ukrainians want to help Trump be a historic figure. Then he kind of paints this in this back. He says the business leaders from Ukraine called Trump's commitment in the Oval Office to Zelensky in February that the Ukrainian leader had no cards to play. That's what Trump said. Now the businessmen say it's becoming more clear to Trump that the Ukraine has three very significant cards. First is the strength of the Ukrainian people. Second, the strength of Ukraine's armed forces. And third, the bravery of its president. Dude, listen, that is the most thinnest and embarrassing things that he said this whole time. At least in the previous part, he was talking about, listen, there are, you know, lots of technology and all this that that goes along with it. And, you know, those are drones, and that's actually has lethal effects on the battlefield. At least you have something there. You should be talking about both sides of that equation. You're not. Okay, I'll take you to task for that. But this one, I mean, come on. Seriously. You want to butter up Trump? You want to help him be a historical figure? You think you have that to offer him? And then his justification. It's the bravery of Zelensky. It's the strength of the army. It's not. That's being self-evidently not. 147,000 desertions this year. Does that sound to you like the bravery of the Ukrainian army? These figures are coming from the Ukraine side, by the way. Not from the Russian, not claims. This is what's being reported. These are legal actions that are being recorded in ledger, legal ledgers on the Ukraine side, not a made up number. That's what it is so far this year, as of September. Don't know what it is now. One would imagine it's in the same status because that's way up from the rate that they were suffering desertions even in 2024. And they're dying in large numbers as well. And you've seen everybody, if they're being remotely honest, has seen scores, hundreds now, of these videos throughout Ukraine where these people go, these so-called recruiters, that they literally seize men off the ground, take them out of their houses, take them from stores, I mean, wherever they can find them, because nobody's wanting to, not in any numbers, are willing to do this peacefully. They run from it because they view it as a death sentence. That is not the strength of the nation. And then you see from November of 2023 to the current day here, so now almost two full years, it has been nothing but a methodical Russian move west. You can argue that they're slow. You can mock them that they've only taken 1% of a total territory, whatever you want to do, but they're moving forward and they are killing large numbers of Ukraine soldiers every day. That's the truth of it. And now then we have in the air, Russia has ramped up its air component because of their production in the strategic drones, the Garand-2s, the various hypersonic missiles and the various classes of other missiles that they have nearly every single night. And again, last night, huge portions of Kiev were knocked into darkness. Odessa the day before. You just see, yeah, there's some of them you see on the screen. These are just from last night. I mean, we can show you these from nearly every day. This is what's been going on. And so it's ramping up. So Ukraine has less and less ability to shoot these things down. And it doesn't matter what the U.S. does in response, this alleged $90 billion, because there aren't the assets to give them, whether the money can be found or not. This passes for so-called elite thinking in the West right now. It is self-delusional. It is fraudulent. And the only thing we can calculate just based on the evidence that we have is that it's designed to carry forth a narrative so that the money keeps flowing and that it supports what a lot of these leaders who've come from countries where a lot of this money is being provided to the Atlantic Council to it goes. And who's the bill payer? I keep saying this, and it's important to point out, I do not want to get away from this. We claim with our mouths that we care about the Ukrainians, that we care about freedom and all that nonsense that he said at the beginning of this article. And yet the evidence shows that your actions and people who listen to reports like this are getting more Ukrainian men killed, more Ukrainian cities turned to rubble, more images like what Gary's showing you right now on the screen. That's the result, my friend. That's the ramifications of this. Yeah, you get your coffers filled. You get money in your pockets. This is what you're giving to the Ukrainian people. You're making sure that Russia continues on with its onslaught. Instead of reaching a negotiated settlement in April of 2022, just a couple of months in, that would have eliminated every bit of this. No, we can't have that. And then the opportunity in November of 2022, the opportunity in June of 2024, after the complete and utterly disastrous failed offensive in 2023. Every time you had a chance for a diplomatic off-ramp to save the Ukrainian people and preserve something left for a future and a hope and an actual state that could function in the future, you refused that. And in fact, the only thing you talk about, this is writ large, not just organizations like the Atlantic Council, but all through the European Union, Ursula von der Leyen, Emmanuel Macron, Merz, Keir Starmer, all of these folks, Mark Rutte, all you do, the only thing in your lexicon is more war and more support while Ukraine burns. That's your legacy that you're leaving. You're going to leave a moonscape behind that's a broken people, that's been stripped and ripped apart of its future manhood, that it needs to just survive as a nation. And you keep shoveling more bodies into that fire with claps, yay, freedom, and all these words that are thin that mean nothing like on this paper here. That is the legacy that we're building right now, and why I say that the elite in the United States and also in the Western world is destroying itself, because it refuses to acknowledge reality and it seeks after the almighty dollar. Well done, Atlantic Council. You succeeded on your money platform. Good job. Anyway, that's where we are today. I felt it was really important to bring that out. We are going to have Matthew Ho back today at 1 o'clock, a little bit less than an hour from now, where Russia's knockout blow to the Ukrainian energy grid. Gary showed you some of the scenes there a second ago. We're going to be talking a lot more about that with Matthew Ho, well, with some of the other issues that are in the news today. Look forward to Matthew Ho then at 1 o'clock, and we'll see you then on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.